Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's a common fact of life that things and people are so often just not what they seem. For instance, most know Thomas Mann for his jewelry and metal art, but he's also a not-so-secret foodie, especially not now that he's competing on the Food Network's new show, All-Star Academy. And author Jill Benson knows that these days New Orleans food is often not what's usually expected. She and collaborator Sam Hanna tell how their new book, Fun, Funky, and Fabulous, came together. Then, Chris Boucher, industrial hemp advocate, explains the benefits of a plant often demonized as the devil's weed, cannabis sativa. We're taking a long look on both sides of the fence on this week's Louisiana Eats. Regular Louisiana Eats listeners already know our roving reporter, Jill Benson. But Jill isn't just our reporter. She's also a prolific food writer and most recently the author of a new cookbook, Fun, Funky, and Fabulous, New Orleans Casual Restaurant Recipes. I sat down with Jill and her collaborator, photographer Sam Hanna, to hear how the book came to be. Jill, how did you and Sam cook this book up?
This is my second cookbook. This is the first one I've done as just mine. The last one was the Galatoire's cookbook for Random House in 2005, and I wrote that for the family. Collaborated with Sam Hanna on this. He's the photographer, and Sam is brilliant and was just huge on this project. As an illustration of Sam's brilliance, I produced some of the recipes for this book. Well, they were ugly, and sometimes food is ugly. And the ooey gooey cake on page 112 was, while divine, and it didn't last very long, it was particularly ugly. When I presented this to Sam and said, well, we have to photograph this, but maybe we shouldn't use this for the book, he said, well, with his British accent, he said, well, it's going to be a challenge. And he stood there and looked at this thing. And he's so brilliant with lighting that it just looks incredible. So check out page 112, and it's just an irresistible dish.
So tell us a little bit about you, Sam.
So, well, I'm Sam Hanna, and yes, I do professional food photography now in New Orleans, which was my goal when I first moved down here, as a challenge from my brother, might I add.
Who's your brother? Big reveal.
Big reveal? Tarek Hanna.
Tarek Hanna.
Of Sucre.
So if anybody's ever seen those beautiful macaroons and such, pictures of that, that's your photography.
I shot them, then ate them. So when we shoot macaroons, for example, there's probably 36 of them there, and I'm only shooting 3 or 4. But I tell them to bring that many so I have some extras to eat.
Absolutely.
It's pretty normal. Yeah. But this is the first cookbook I've photographed in its entirety. And, of course, first time working with Jill. Prior to that, I collaborated with Kit Wall, who, by the way, thank you for getting us all together. And
yay, Kit.
Can't not forget about her. But so after doing that, I got introduced to Jill, and Jill had this crazy idea for this crazy book. And we talked about it, and we got along, and we just said, yes, let's do it. And here we are today.
The name of the book is Fun, Funky, and Fabulous, New Orleans Casual Restaurant Recipes. What does that say about the book? How do you qualify to be fun, funky, and fabulous?
When I see the title, I think it's just really pertaining to the fact that it's not of the very traditional cuisine that comes out of New Orleans. It's all these chefs who are somewhat newish to the scene with their own restaurants. They might have experience in other places in New Orleans, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they've decided to take their own expertise and come out with their own new way of, whether it's fusion of some sort, like, you know, mofo, or they have their own, like I said, non-traditional New Orleans cuisine, but yet it's, I guess, breaking the mold.
Yeah,
if
you're not going to find any traditional seafood gumbo, for instance, in this book.
Correct. And the way Jill can take a complex recipe and break it down to something that any home cook, shall I say, can decipher is a big deal. So I actually read one of the recipes. It made sense to me.
Jill, that's one of your Jill, that's one of your really great talents among many, many, many is your ability to really know how to work a recipe. So when you approach these chefs, first of all, how did you get the recipes out of them?
You just ask. It's amazing. People are, how did you get Michael Galata to share these recipes with you? And Michael Galata is the brilliant young chef over at MoFo.
He is.
I'm his number one fan. He's incredible. Well, if you ask, typically people are willing to help you. And we have a lot of fun in the studio. We will invite chefs to come in and work with us at what we call the Cookbook Studio. And the studio is based out of Kit Wall's space in just at the edge of Central City. I think the first chef who came in to work with us, and I cannot remember who it was on this project, but they had so much fun because we have such a great energy in the studio. A chef will show up to shoot one or two dishes and end up just hanging out with us all day because it's very kumbaya, and there's a great, great synergy and lots of room for creativity, and everyone has a voice. And I worked in a past lifetime. I was a culinary publicist for many years, which is how I ended up writing Galatoire's book. And I had many other chef clients throughout the course of my career. And most chefs are terrible recipe writers. Tori McPhail, who was not one of my clients, but he was a friend, he gave me a recipe, and the instructions were cook until cooked. And people don't understand what that means. So I found myself developing the skill of reading chefs' minds and then effectively translating what they were trying to do onto paper and then handing it back to them. And they'd say, oh, yeah, that's right. You got it. So that was a weird skill I discovered I have. Everything in this book, you can see the underpinning of the Louisiana heritage style in all of these recipes and in everything that these chefs are doing. But they're all the way they're doing something is different, or what they're doing is different. For example, Linda Green is doing New Orleans-based heritage soul food, and she's our Yucca Maine lady, but she's doing it out of the back of a truck. And it isn't a food truck, it's a pickup truck, and she does it, on second line routes.
Let's talk a little bit about that photography process. How do you do that?
How do you do that? With a camera. Well, one of the things is I used to be a food editor in Detroit for a publishing company. So, and I would look through cookbooks and look at, even if you go to a restaurant and they have pictures on their menu or whatever it is. And I always look at some pictures or photographs that I look at and go, that's not special. But then you go and look at something that is a published book, if I could say it, through a major chain. And I think, okay, what's different about these photographs? And it really all boils down to how you see it and approach it. So we can put in the same dish and have 10 different people photograph it, and each one will look different. It's how you perceive that dish. So for me personally, I like being up close and personal with the dish, because if you're going to fill up a page, you want that to look bigger than life. That's been my thing about photographing food. It has to look bigger than life. But it really also boils down to lighting. And so I make sure everything is set up so that whatever's brought, whether it's an ooey gooey cake or whether it's a slider to some, like ribs, whatever it may be, the idea is to make everything, all the texture show up in that food. If it has texture, it needs to show.
Well, when we determine what dishes, we typically shoot on a Wednesday. That's our studio day. And when we'll determine the week before what we're shooting the following week. And I'm also the project manager. So I will send everyone a list of what it is that we'll be shooting. And then I go shopping. And I will spend days prepping and getting everything assembled the night before. And then I will bring everything to Kit's studio, which has a full working test kitchen within the studio. So we're very fortunate to have that. And I will start assembling the dishes. We'll have a shot list that we go through. And I will bring the first dish or the components for the first dish into the shooting portion of the studio. And Sam and Kit take over from there. And I'm back in the kitchen. And then they will shout for the next dish. And then I repeat the process.
Or Jill, slow down. We're not done yet.
Exactly. Sometimes I'm told I must slow down. If we have a chef, or in the case of Juan's Flying Burrito, they brought a full crew. I think they brought six guys with them.
Five guys to watch how it's made and one to prepare it. But it was a lot of fun.
It was. They were super fun. Yeah, they had fun. Three chefs with them. The owner was there. One of the partners was there. It was a party that day. And so the chefs will all be hanging out in the kitchen with me. And, Sam, sometimes, we'll holler for Sam to come back into the kitchen to determine, how this needs to be plated. It's just, it's a microcosm of how everything should be with regard to work going through seamlessly and everyone having a voice. And it just, the vision just comes together.
The environment we work in is, it's not quite the norm. And even the chefs, when they were there, they had not experienced anything like this. And they've worked with other photographers and other, but something about being there with us, they seemed, newly inspired, and they were like, oh, maybe we want to do a book on our stuff.
We heard that from just about everyone,
and they thought, so they get inspired about these things. And the way we work, it's food, okay? It's fun. It has to be fun. It's not a stiff, militant situation. So, yeah.
Well, I just want to congratulate the both of you on this first collaboration, and I have a deep-seated feeling that this is not the first and the last. I'm sure there'll be more delicious and yummy works like this coming down the pike from the great team of Sam Hanna and Jill Benson.
We have more in the works already, Poppy.
Well, great.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much
for
revealing all these secrets to us on Louisiana Eats.
Thanks, Poppy.
Thank you, Poppy.
Be sure to pick up Jill and Sam's book, Fun, Funky, and Fabulous, New Orleans Casual Restaurant Recipes. Available everywhere delicious books are sold. In writing Fun, Funky, and Fabulous, Jill Benson managed to sweet-talk chefs out of recipes that have played a large part in the recent evolution of New Orleans food. Isaac Toops of Toops Meadery parted with his recipe for what he calls chicken liver mousse for all seasons. By altering spirits and spices, Isaac takes his chicken liver mousse from the sweltering heat of summer to winter's icy blast. Here's his basic technique. Sauté the chicken livers until they're medium rare. That only takes about a minute per side. Then add port, bourbon, sugar, cloves, cinnamon, and salt. If you're making a summer mousse, substitute Lillet for the bourbon and lemon zest for the cloves and cinnamon. Simmer for another few minutes until the livers are cooked through. Chill down the mixture and then put it in your food processor with cream cheese, salt, and pepper. Process until smooth, then put the mousse into ramekins and chill till ready to serve. Slather this yumminess onto rustic country bread with radishes and cornichons. This is easy and delicious, just like all the recipes in Jill's new book. You'll find a copy of this recipe on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com and wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. February is National Marijuana Awareness Month. When we come back, industrial hemp advocate Chris Boucher joins us to discuss the history of marijuana's kissing cousin, hemp. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. For millennia, hemp has been one of the most versatile plants on the planet. Used to make everything from fuel and rope to paper and food, hemp was found on every ship traversing the Atlantic and was a mandatory crop for the settlers at Jamestown. But by the 1930s, hemp was demonized in the United States. Powerful men were convinced that marijuana was corrupting the status quo and needed to be outlawed. Here's Chris Boucher, an industrial hemp advocate, with the backstory.
If you go back to the 1930s and you look at the Marijuana Tax Act, that's the actual law that outlawed hemp marijuana. And it was a sad story because Henry Aslinger, who was the head of the narcotics division, he was a renowned racist, and he was best friends with William Randolph Hearst. And these guys produced Reefer Madness. They ran front page stories about minorities smoking marijuana and murdering white women and murdering families. It was just, I mean, the sensationalism that was in these stories, you know, people believed that when they wrote it. And, you know, in 1938, Popular Mechanics came out. The cover story was called The First $1 Billion Crop. The first $1 billion crop in American history happens to be hemp. They outlawed it that same year. It was a quick, fast congressional hearing. I think the only people that showed up was a representative from Sherman Williams Paint, because all your paints and varnishes were made from hemp seed. And I think a guy from the American bird food industry was there also and testified. He said, "Listen, if you outlaw the hemp seeds, my canaries won't sing." So that's where they still allowed in the law that you could use the seed for oil and food, you could use the fiber for clothing and textiles, but you couldn't grow the plant. It was just really, you know, ridiculous.
And so hemp got lumped together with its sensational companion, marijuana. Still unclear about the difference between the two? Here's what you need to know. Both hemp and marijuana are derivatives of cannabis sativa, but only one of them has an active chemical in it that gets you high. That chemical is THC, and it's found in the buds of marijuana. Hemp, on the other hand, has no THC, and is all of the other stuff, like stems, leaves, and seeds. Ask your friendly neighborhood pot smoker, and they'll tell you they don't want any of that stuff in their pipe. Now, in the past several years, as marijuana has been legalized in several states and more research has been conducted on cannabis, scientists have learned about another chemical component in it. This one's called CBD and is found in the stalks of hemp. After 25 years in the hemp business, Chris believes that CBD is just another reason why America needs to do away with its antiquated laws and legalize hemp cultivation.
THC gets you high, and CBD gets you healthy, I like to say. So industrial hemp is like a non-alcoholic beer, where marijuana would be, you know, an alcoholic beer. With industrial hemp, I mean, you could smoke a joint the size of a telephone pole and not get high. All the growers have bred the CBD, the cannabidiol, out of marijuana because it brings your high down. Lo and behold, all this cancer research and stuff on tumors, epilepsy, whether you're conservative, liberal, left, right, down the center, you cannot turn your back on this. When you see the medical benefits that it can do, especially with kids, older people, that's where the CBD comes in. And so our market, where we're at, is we deal with a lot of people that want these benefits, but they don't want the psychoactive ingredient THC.
So you extract this ingredient, CBD. What happens to the byproduct?
Well, we grow industrial hemp. What we do is all of our farmers, we have about 3,000 acres of industrial hemp that we grow in Europe. And all the hemp, it's all certified in order for the farmers to get the seeds. We have permits from the countries. And it has to be certified 0.3% THC just to start growing it. That way, there's no marijuana, no one's going to get high. And part of our business model at Canavest is we're investing into the infrastructure of the whole industrial hemp industry. And a matter of fact, Canavest was the first company to actually help grow hemp since the 1940s in Kentucky. We sponsored a couple programs at Murray State University. We actually helped sponsor and donated seeds to the Growing Warriors. It's an offshoot of Wounded Warriors, teaching, you know, veterans how to get into agriculture. They grew some hemp in Kentucky. The University of Kentucky, we donated seeds there. We're just really doing variety trials, finding the right seed that grows in that climate. And that way, the farmer, he gets the full benefit. And if we can have it made in America, I think it would be even more supportive, people knowing that this is helping a local farmer. And that's what we really need. That's what this country was founded on, agriculture, and kind of lost our way a little bit. And now it's all, like to say, we're shifting back to that carbohydrate-based economy.
Sales. So, you know, there are new laws coming on board in various states about recreational marijuana. Is this something that people can buy in, you know, the southern states, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, places where marijuana certainly isn't legal today and that legalization is probably long away on the horizon?
Yes. Well, the legal opinion is with CBD, it's legal in all 50 states. I like to say there's more opiates in a poppy seed bagel than there is THC in a hemp food bar or a hemp oil. And there was a survey done 2 years ago, and it was estimated to be over $550 million a year in hemp products being sold in America, whether that was shampoos, whether it was granola bars, whether it was hemp milk, hemp clothing. So 2 years ago, it was a $550 million industry, and it's all imported. So we look at the fact, if we could grow it here, how fast would that $550 million grow? And I think we could double it in the next 2 to 3 years. So we could bring the hemp part of it up to a billion-dollar industry without being too optimistic. You know, I think it's there. The sales are there. And, you know, I don't want to get into detail, but the study was done by the SPIN study, and they're just this intricate corporate research firm, did this study, and they didn't include Whole Foods in the study. So can you imagine including Whole Foods, all the hemp products they sold there? So
wow.
We've got ourselves a tiger, you know. This thing, it's selling. People are running to the store and buying it.
From an agricultural point of view, does it make more sense for farmers to grow hemp or conventional marijuana? What does this all roll out to in dollars and cents?
Well, I think if we can get back to the foundation of just agriculture where, you know, the farmer, you know, if he's got 10, 20 acres or 100 acres, they need to make a profit. I mean, growing marijuana, there's a lot of security involved, a lot of overhead, where with industrial hemp, it's pretty easy to plant. It's a weed. It grows pretty good, you know, as long as you grow it consistently and get enough sunshine and enough water, of course. And I think that's where the real benefit is in the mass agricultural market. Like in Kentucky, they call it the college crop. Back in the day, you could grow, you know, a couple acres of tobacco, and you could make enough money from that tobacco to send one of your kids to college. And that's what we want to do with industrial hemp. We're a farmer can make enough money growing it, get a fair, reasonable price, and, you know, make enough money to send one of his kids to college each year.
Are there any rules and regulations governing what's happening to the byproducts? Our research has told us that there's actually a pig farmer in Washington who has been feeding his herd marijuana stalks, roots, and leaves. So, you know, now it's legal in Washington State. So everything that's not going into the commissaries for the bud tenders to sell is going into the hands of this pig farmer and being used to feed his herd of swine. And I guess, you know, it's sort of a mystery what the taste benefits in the ultimate pulled pork sandwich come out to be. But do you know anything about that, Chris?
Yeah, there's a big, huge market in Canada with the hemp byproduct, for instance. Most of your hemp in Canada is grown organically. And the hemp stock, if it's ground up, It can be used as a filler in food, or it can be used as cow bedding or horse bedding, especially with an organic dairy. They also, with the poultry industry in Canada, they've done all kinds of studies on feeding the leftovers to the chickens. It really has a multitude of benefits, not just with humans, but also in the animal industry.
So I guess the message here is that aside from, you know, bringing it back as an agricultural crop and health benefits to the various ways that humans are consuming it, it has some pretty significant implications for our entire food industry.
Yes. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, I always say in the future, you'll get your Fred Flintstone vitamins and you'll have CBD in it. That's how important CBD is. It's just as important as vitamin C. You know, you'll see it in all your protein drinks, your protein powders, all your granola bars. You know, half your cereals on the shelf will have, you know, hemp fiber, hemp protein in it, because it is scientifically known as some of the best protein there is, some of the best essential fatty acids. It's just getting it into these big corporations, whether it's General Mills or Quaker Oats. These, you know, they will definitely, they're looking at it. All the big players are looking at it.
You know, it's very curious because all of this is happening so fast, isn't it?
I always say it's moving like a freight train. The last year and a half, I've never seen the movement of hemp cannabis move this quickly on legislation on the state level, on the federal level. The most important factor right now in the entire cannabis, hemp, marijuana industry is removing cannabis, whether it's industrial hemp, marijuana, removing it from Schedule 1. The federal government considers this a Schedule 1 drug, which basically has no medicinal value, no value whatsoever. It's in the same category, you know, as heroin and LSD. So we need to distinguish the difference between these plants and remove it from Schedule 1. And once it's removed from Schedule 1, you're going to see the Wall Street guys, the suit and coat guys, they're all coming in. They're all standing at the edge right now, waiting to invest in these industries. But currently right now, since it's Schedule 1, the big money cannot invest in it as of yet.
What's fueling it? What do you think is making it go so fast right now?
I think it's just information. We live in this information age. It's just at your fingertips. I mean, right now, people are probably listening to the show and looking up some of this information instantaneously, and they're seeing that, hey, this isn't a lie. This is the truth. I mean, you imagine 70 years of the government removing all this information out of our textbooks, out of our history books, out of our pharmacopoeia, and then at the same time, putting out movies like Reefer Madness and, you know, saying this is the most dangerous drug known to mankind. So the tide has turned. The government is no longer doing misinformation campaigns. They're actually sponsoring and financing research. You know, I see this thing in the next 3 or 4 years just really moving rapidly in many different directions, and I see a whole new eco-economy being niched out of this cannabis industry, whether it's hemp, whether it's recreational marijuana, whether it's medical marijuana. They all come from the same plant, and eventually it's going to be one big giant industry, and you're going to see Wall Street involved, and it's probably some good investments out there if people look around.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing your boundless knowledge on this topic, and we're going to hang on to your phone number because I think the food world and the cannabis world are likely to connect again.
Thank you, Poppy, for your time and letting me just explain some of the facts and history about hemp. It's been exciting.
Chris Boucher, Vice President of Cannavest, an industrial hemp advocate. You can find Cannavest products at your nearest health store or visit cannavest.com for more information. Would have thought that cannabis was actually good for you. Now let's swing over to nutritionist Molly Kimball with another guilty pleasure that you don't have to feel so guilty about. Molly, Welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
What's the topic on the table today?
I think it's a lot of people's favorites, chocolate.
Chocolate. So healthy, not healthy?
On that one, this really is a it depends, because there's a lot of different types of chocolate, and even things that look like they may be dark chocolate that are better for us, the labeling might be a little bit misleading.
So how do we find out? What should we be looking for?
Okay, so when we're looking to get the maximum benefits from dark chocolate, because it's specifically dark chocolate that's giving us these benefits, it's the cocoa component in here, what we want to look for is a minimum of 70% cocoa. And when that happens, whenever a product is that high, it's not cheap for the companies to do it. Sugar is easy, that sugar's cheap. So when they're having a product that's going to be at least 70%, they're going to brag about it. It's going to be the front of that product. You're not going to have to dig and search and turn it over that much to look for it. So if you see dark chocolate and you don't see the percentage anywhere on it, I can promise you it might be in the 40s, 50s, if not even lower. There's not really legally a term for the phrase dark chocolate. So they can put it if it's not even really that high of a percentage.
And what does cocoa do for us?
So there's a whole host of benefits. Number one, if people really, really love it, simply it brings them pleasure, it makes them happy. And there are compounds in chocolate that actually can help to boost our mood. So when we're feeling, oh gosh, I'm crabby, I'm having a rough day, chocolate will solve it. It may not solve those problems, but there is, you know, physiologically a reason it can help us feel better. Chocolate can also help to lower our blood pressure. It can help us improve our cholesterol, all of this helping to reduce our risk of cardiovascular disease. It helps increase our blood flow, and it even helps to improve our brain function.
I'm really confused now, because it seems to me that there must be saturated fats in cocoa and in chocolate. And so how can that help improve your cholesterol?
Good point. Good point. So when you look at the darker the better on dark chocolate, not only does the nutritional value go up in these health benefits of the cocoa itself, that super dark chocolate surprisingly is actually relatively high in fiber. But you're right, there is still some saturated fat in there. But interestingly, the type of saturated fat that's in chocolate has really zero effect on our cholesterol levels. It's a type of saturated fat called stearic acid, and it's completely neutral as far as our cholesterol level goes.
Now, there's so much talk about dark chocolate being a good choice if you're going to eat chocolate. But when we talk about milk chocolate versus dark chocolate, really, what's the difference?
Oh, there's a gigantic difference.
Well, besides taste.
Right. Well, there's taste. If I'm looking at milk chocolate, the percent of cocoa of a lot of types of milk chocolate may be as low as 20%. White chocolate has no cocoa in here. So if you're looking for the health benefits, you're really not getting much with milk chocolate, and you're not getting any with white chocolate. And you're getting a higher sugar content. So if you're having, you know, that little bit of milk chocolate, a little square or whatever it is, and it just brings you happiness and you're able to keep that, you know, portion in control and all that, that's fine. You're having it. You've built it into your nutrition and it works for you. But you're not getting the biggest bang for your buck as you would with that high intensity, high percentage dark chocolate. But, you know, there's also, we get caught up in chocolate bars or all the different, you know, chocolate squares and these that we see, but there's all different types that we can add beyond that. So if you ever see in the bulk bins of grocery stores, kind of where they have the nuts and different grains, look for cocoa nibs. And what that is, it's actually the cocoa bean that's kind of crumbled. And it's a crunchy little gritty texture. And it's not super sweet, but that is one of the more concentrated sources, even more than dark chocolate, of these antioxidants. And sprinkling that in your Greek yogurt, putting it in anything that you might sprinkle, say, berries or flaxseed in, you could sprinkle these cocoa nibs. Another thing would be just using the unsweetened cocoa powder, just like your regular old cocoa powder. Put that in smoothies, stir it into things, and then you have zero sugar, but all the health benefits of that cocoa.
Well, I feel so ready for a big chocolate bar. How about you?
Well, I'm glad you said big chocolate bar. That's another thing. You know, there's always the, yeah, hang on, just don't get so excited just yet. It is something that, you know, if we're adding it in, it can be high calorie. You know, so a couple of squares of chocolate, maybe 100 calories, 150. A lot of people have that wiggle room in their diet. But if you're really watching your weight, trade it out for something else. So if you've got some other type of white carb or sweet that you're having as that indulgence, trade that out for that extra dark cocoa so that you are keeping those calories in check.
Okay, Molly.
All right.
We'll get a bar and we'll split it up in little pieces.
Thank you. And share with me.
Okay, that's a deal. Thanks, Molly.
All right. Thank you for having me, Poppy.
Please come back and see us soon. Registered dietitian, Molly Kimball. When we come back from the next break, jeweler and metal artist Thomas Mann joins us with tales of his Food Network debut. He's appearing on a new competition show called All Star Academy. Spoiler alert, one of the dishes he prepared is aguachile. Do you know what that is? Stay tuned, and we'll tell you all about it when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is aguachile? Aguachile is a type of ceviche that hails from the Sinaloa region of northwestern Mexico. Aguachile differs from other ceviches because the chilies, usually jalapeno and serrano, are pulverized with water, that would be the agua, before being added to the raw fish. Also, it doesn't marinate for a period of time like ceviche usually does. The raw seafood is just tossed with the lime juice and chilies, then served immediately, much like sushi. Avocados and tostadas are the ordinary accompaniments, all washed down with tequila and beer, of course. Give aguachile a try while you cheer on our friend Thomas Mann on the Food Network's All-Star Academy. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. Many of you may know Thomas Mann's jewelry, but it's my guess that you don't know Thomas Mann's food. Actually, Thomas Mann, the New Orleans jeweler and metal artist, is also an accomplished cook and recently had the opportunity to show off his chops on Food Network's upcoming competitive cooking show, All Star Academy. Tom, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
It's a pleasure to be here, Poppy. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so full disclosure, we'll get to this part later, but I am your off-the-record cooking coach.
That is true, and enormously helpful in kind of upping my game, for sure.
Well, thank you. I know that you were really nervous before you set out on this adventure, but take us back to the very, very, very beginning. How in the world did you be invited onto a food show?
It kind of went like this, is that I've been, cooking pretty seriously for the past 10 years at a level beyond a maintenance level. My hobby is like serious cooking. So I've taken courses. I learned how to make ceviche from Chef Adolfo.
Wow.
Fabulous. Just amazing. I make great ceviches. Matter of fact, that's probably what I should have done than what I did.
You've taken a lot of cooking school vacations.
Yeah, exactly. So then, over a year ago, like October of 2013, a friend of mine sent me a link to a website of cooking competition stuff. And so I'm looking down the list, and there's one that says, America's Best Home Cooks Food Network, which was the name of the show before what it is now. Basically, it was an application that vetted your capability to participate with them, and you had to make a video. So one night for 7 hours, I shot my own video and then edited it of me doing Roy Choi's ketchup fried rice.
Wow.
It was great. And the video turned out great. I was very happy with it. We sent it in by the deadline to what turned out to be basically a casting company in Chicago, and I never heard a word.
Okay.
Never heard a thing. No, so I said, you know, I'm just one of thousands of people who send this stuff in, you know?
Right. Fall 2013.
Right.
And then what happens?
A year later, just I'm at work one day. I get a phone call. Hey, we really like your video, and we're really interested in having you participate in this year's filming of the show. So, again, I had to do the application. I had to make another video, right? And this one was me doing a dinner party with friends in my space. And they wanted me to do more dishes. They wanted me to submit more visuals to them. So I did 14 dishes, cooked them, plated them, photographed them, set up a photo studio in my building, you know, the Rose Tattoo, where I live on Napoleon Avenue, and then sent all of that in. And then I had to be interviewed on Skype.
At this point, I would say you have really proven yourself to these people. I mean, my goodness, I can't imagine all the work that went into this. So you get the gig. When do they finally tell you you're on?
Basically, about a week before I'm supposed to go.
Oh, my goodness.
And I asked them the question. I said, well, how many people can rearrange their lives in such short notice to be able to make a gig like this? And they said, well, you either want to do it or you don't.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's nice. And you're so lucky because at your gallery, you've got such a great staff.
I have an incredible staff who are capable of running the business without me around. Matter of fact, sometimes they prefer that I'm not there.
Well, now that you've been through this enormous vetting process, you must be pretty intimidated about who else is bringing a similar game to the event. And so that's when you called me and you were like, Poppy, there's everything I don't know, and I got to go in a week, and I need a KitchenAid. I need a KitchenAid.
I need a KitchenAid mixer. I need to know how to use a KitchenAid mixer.
Yeah. And so I bring you my KitchenAid mixer. Bring you my very best
all the books,
reference books. And what did you do in that week or so to prepare? What were you cooking?
Well, I'd been preparing from the moment they called me. I started preparing. I didn't wait until I got the actual gig. For the whole month before you came in with the final stuff there, I had been learning sauces, learning how to do souffles, learning how to do eggs, period, because I had heard that one of the tests they were given last year was you got three eggs and you had to do a souffle and an omelet and a hard-boiled egg, you know, with just one egg.
Perfectly,
with
yeah.
just one egg.
And also, another interesting twist to this is that normally you're not a meat eater. You're not totally a vegetarian, but you're still pescatarian, right?
I call myself an ovo-lacto-piscean vegetarian.
Okay.
Poultry, fish.
We'll put a translation to that on the website.
Right. But I do, I'm very weak on the meat side for sure. Although every now and then when my girlfriend looks like she needs a steak, you know, I'll do steak a poivre or, you know, or something like that, because I know that I have to get the meat thing down too. So I mean, all that month I was doing, I did some pork, I did some beef, I did a couple of different variations of basic things, so that I wouldn't be all that intimidated if a hunk of beef landed on my to-do list when I got on the show.
Okay, you know? Okay. So then you head to New York,
right,
where they're going to lock you in seclusion with
right.
your fellow other nine contestants, because it starts
right.
off a group of 10, right?
Right.
Okay, so it comes time to shoot. How does that go?
Well, they told us just beforehand, just before we're going to do this, what our ingredients were going to be. So we walk on set basically knowing that. So you have some time, a little bit of time anyway, to think about what you might do. And then they introduce you, before they're shooting, they introduce you to all of the setup there. So you know where the refrigerators are and where the equipment is and where the platings are, et cetera. But not much time at all. And then it's kind of like go time. They put you in your stations. They announce the start of the whole thing, and everybody's running around like, you know, chickens with their heads cut off to grab all of the equipment and materials that they need to do their dish.
And by the way, on this set, the cooking stadium set,
yeah,
it's not just you and your nine fellow contestants, but part of your enticement here were the really big name celebrity chefs who were the judges. So who was there to judge?
Well, they do this. It's all about the drama. So they introduce us to the chefs and they walk in, you know, one at a time. And it's Curtis Stone and Alex Gornishelli and then Michael Simon and then Bobby Flay. And we're all going nuts and yelling and all this kind of stuff. And their mission is to pick teams, right? They're going to pick four teams, two people on a team out of the 10 people there.
So the first cooking competition, how long do you have and what do you do? What's your strategy and what did you pull off?
I have to say that the environment was really kind of intimidating because, I mean, it's very high pressure. It's 45 minutes to do all of this stuff. You have to run around and get all this equipment and materials. And like, for instance, some of the things I needed weren't there in the refrigerator, even though I'd seen them there earlier in the morning. They were gone because someone, instead of taking one bag of cilantro, took the whole bag of bags, kind of a deal. Now you're yelling across the whole environment about where, hey, who's got the cilantro? Who's got the shrimp? You know,
yeah,
kind of a deal. And then trying to patch that together. And so I'm a little nervous. And of course, then, you know, Michael Simon, you know, he's a neat freak. And he comes down, he makes a comment about my station.
What does he say?
Well, I don't want to say exactly, but just it's like, you know, it's like, okay, over my shoulder, it's like I'm not being neat.
Intimidation.
And I normally, when I do cook, I am normally very organized, mise en place and that whole thing. I'm into all of that.
Tell us a little bit about the other contestants, if you can. Who are these other people and what kind of intimidation level were you feeling from them?
Well, number one, nobody was over 40. And here I am, the geezer in the group, right?
Oh, yeah, Grandpa.
Yeah. And most of them were in their 20s. I felt comfortable. I didn't feel like I thought I was amongst kind of like peers.
Great.
You know, because we...
Think young, Tom. So I know you fit in with the crew. When we tune in... What are we going to see? How
well, you're going to see the initial round of cooking that's going to basically lead up to the first cut, because they only need eight people and there's 10 of us.
Okay. And
the judges are going to pick their teams. And then the most interesting part for me about this was that in order to get first pick of the people that they've all witnessed now and vetted basically through their system, they have to compete just like we did.
Ah.
They're given a set of four ingredients, and they have to go perform and be judged to see who wins the opportunity to make the first pick.
Okay.
And so now, instead of them being up on the platforms behind us watching us, we're on the platforms watching them.
I'm sure you learned a bunch of things just from that.
Oh, actually, I have to say that the month of November and the experience in New York was absolutely one of the things I'll remember the rest of my life. It was really good. I learned so much from preparing for it and then doing it, that it will be a valuable, you know, life lesson for a long time.
Well, that's great. And I am so happy for you that you got to realize another lifelong dream.
Absolutely. And I lead a charmed life, Poppy.
You do, Thomas Mann. Thank you so much for telling us this great tale.
Right.
And I know I'll be glued to my television set on Sunday nights throughout this spring. Come back again soon.
Cheers.
You can find out more about Thomas Mann and his jewelry at thomasmann.com. And be sure to watch him on Food Network's All-Star Academy, premiering Sunday, March 1st. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickie Brennan & Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to our production team, Thomas Walsh, Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.